welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us for our roundtable discussion, 21st Century Federalism, A View from the States. We often think of the relationship between states and the federal government as a static arrangement, but federalism in reality is highly dynamic. The states often serve as important guarantors of individual rights not protected by the federal constitution. They also serve to check the excesses of the president and Congress in our federal system. Our discussion today will cover these issues and more. Our panelists have an exciting range of topics to discuss, and we are glad to have them with us today. Please join me in welcoming our moderator for this roundtable, the Honorable Naomi J. Rao. Judge Rao sits on the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. Prior to joining the bench, Judge Rao served as the administrator of the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, and before that, in various roles in the Bush administration and as a professor at the Antonin Scalia School of Law. Please join me in welcoming Judge Rao and our panel today.
Thank you so much for that introduction, and thank you to the University of Virginia's Federal Society for inviting me. You guys have put on a great symposium, so many interesting topics and panels and speakers, and so I commend you on that. And I'm very happy to be here to moderate this panel. So the way we're going to proceed, I'll just briefly introduce our panelists. They will make some opening remarks, and then we will open it up for a moderated discussion. So leading off, we have Chief Judge Sutton of the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. We have Justice Goodwin Liu of the California Supreme Court, and Professor Julia Mahoney of this very law school. So with that, I will let Jeff take it away.
All right. Thank you, Naomi. Thank you to UVA. My son was a graduate from last year, was on Fed Sox, so it's really fun to be back with you all, and thank you for inviting me. Let me start with, it's very hard to find a tasteful COVID story, but let me see if this one counts. So about, fall of 2020, I'm teaching at Ohio State, and if you remember, that not an easy time, not an easy time to be a dean of a law school, and so they were trying to accommodate live learning, hybrid, a little of everything, and so the first day of class, I'm actually in an auditorium about this size at Ohio State, and we get the folks that are online on the screen, so I'm looking at a screen, we've got them there, and then I've got students obviously suitably spaced in front of me, everyone with masks, and if you've taught with a mask or spoken for a long time with a mask, you know it's not easy, your mouth gets dry and just not great, but of course necessary certainly back then. And just as class was about to begin, I thought to myself, I should have brought a bottle of water. One, my mouth's gonna get dry, and two, it's kind of a great explanation for keeping your mask down for a little while if you're getting a little annoyed. And then I remembered that Ohio State, to its credit, put together this goodie bag of COVID caution stuff, and so instructions, Ohio State masks, wipes, and at the bottom, bottle of water. So just as we're about to start, I grab it, big slip, and I go, sanitizer. to my credit, I did not spit it out on the people, you know, a little bit in front of me. And then I'm thinking to myself, seventh grade science, is this one of those poisons you extract in one way or you dilute it? This has got to be a dilution situation. So I don't tell the students what's going on, right? It's first day of class, add drop period, who takes a class from somebody who drinks sanitizer? So I calmly walk out of the class. Amazingly, for all their precautions, they'd left the water fountains going, and so I was able to drink, get back in, never tell them, 2-hour class, and let me just alert you here, I think you don't need this alert, but this taste does not go away until like a very long meal. And so for 2 hours, really awful taste. And then some of you were going, well, there was a silver lining, right? You just had this big shot of high alcohol, you know, content. And what's not to like about that? Well, I'm not a scientist, but let me just tell you, there must be two different types of alcohol. This has none of those properties. It just tastes really bad. So congrats to UVA for getting a really smart speaker to start things off. So I want to just help open it a little bit by just thinking about state courts, states, state constitutions, federalism, through just a few lenses to get us started. And so one would be career, and I was not able to hear Governor Youngkin's remarks yesterday, but I was thrilled to hear he was really pushing state government as a place to go, because that's where I already wanted to start. You know, my biggest break as a lawyer was becoming the Ohio SG in the mid-90s. It may be true, as one of the professors said in the last panel, that it might not be as prestigious to go to Columbus as it is to DC. I'm really not sure that's true, because I guess it turns on how you define prestige. If you define prestige as actually getting something done, I would say going to Columbus or Richmond actually is more prestigious. But I don't think she meant that quite that seriously. I think the real point is the states are more nimble. It's a great place to go as a young lawyer if you want responsibility. And it really was the key break in my career. And maybe more importantly, it was the favorite job I had. I mean, I love my current job, but I never had a better job than being Ohio SG. So that's the perspective of career. Perspective of rule of law and actually being in law school. It's the rare law student that doesn't have some idealism in going to law school. There can be practical reasons for going to law school, but I'd like to think most law students go to law school with some idealism in mind. They care about things like justice, rule of law, fairness. In this country, if you care about rule of law, you have to care about the state courts and state constitutions that goes with it. The last year for which we have numbers, the number of civil and criminal cases filed in the country for that year were 83 million. The counterpart number in the federal courts, 400,000. 83 million, 400,000. If you drill down just to criminal, 17 million to 70,000. So I don't know how you can care about the rule of law and not care about what's going on in state courts. I mean, that is where so much of the action is. Every one of those cases, of course, is a case where the state constitution can make a difference. I can't resist saying this is probably explains why we have only one state court judge on the panel and two federal judges, because federal judges don't have that much to do, and the state court judges are so busy they couldn't possibly come to UVA for a panel unless they were very smart, see Justice Liu. This is where so much of the work is done, and you know, oddly enough, the way we teach law school, federal con law, we just ignore that side of the story. Well, ideally, one day you'll have a client. And the other, I think, difficult to disagree with benefit of state courts and state constitutions is, from time to time, the US Supreme Court puts up a big red stop sign. They just say, we're not open for business in that particular area. Now, this is a truth of federalism, is that can happen with respect to so-called blue rights, red rights, progressive, conservative, keeping in mind the danger of labels. The point is, it's completely neutral, but let's just walk through some of the areas where either stop signs have gone up, and you know, once the stop sign goes up, you and your client have just two options. Option A is embrace unhappiness, which, you know, pity works for a little while, but eventually you're going to grow tired of not being able to act on your impulse or conviction in a given area. And option B is you got to go to state courts. That means state legislators sometimes, it means state Supreme Courts, and it sometimes means state constitutional amendments. So, you know, if you think of the current era where we are right now with cases the US Supreme Court the last decade or two and kind of ones winding through the courts, there's a lot of areas where there already is a red stop sign and you only have the chance of the second shot in state court, and others where there's possibly cutting back and a lot of possibilities. So just to, you know, clarify it, we can talk about this in the questioning. So redistricting, obviously the Rucho decision in 2019 says the 14th Amendment, First Amendment does not speak to this issue. And if, like me, you have a problem with extreme partisan gerrymandering, you're gonna have to go to state legislatures, state constitutional amendments, commissions, state courts. You know, my court's a good example of this. And this is an area, by the way, where it's not only dangerous to believe in labels and easy categories, but state courts often don't do what you might expect. I mean, Ohio's a good example of this. Fairly conservative state with a state Supreme Court that has now invalidated the last two Republican redistricting lines after the census. Kelo's a good example of this. The takings clause, I think Professor Mahoney might mention that a little bit. Whether pre-Dobbs or post-Dobbs, there is some room for regulation, and conceivably after Dobbs, there'll be room for regulation at the state court level. As well, school funding is a really good example of this. You know, anyone that cares deeply about property rights, even outside of the takings, so for example, impairment of contract, licensing, economic liberties cases, you know, since Williamson versus Lee Optical have been a tough hill to climb in federal court. It's been climbed some, but not a lot. Not necessarily true in state courts under state constitutions. Judge Willett has a great decision that illustrates that. So the next point is, I guess I'll call it the scholar theoretical perspective. How is it or why is it that a state court could take a different path from the U.S. Supreme Court? So U.S. Supreme Court puts up a stop sign, we're not open for business in that area, and the state court says, well, we are under a comparably worded, sometimes identically worded, state guarantee. Well, I don't really have the authority to impose a homework assignment on you, but just so you know, I'm doing this for free, so I think as a matter of conscience, you should. and it only takes 5 minutes, so tonight, if you don't want to wait, maybe tonight's not a good night, maybe tomorrow night, I want you to understand what you're going to read. And so tomorrow night, just 5 minutes, just pull out Article 1 of your state's constitution or the constitution of the state you're planning to practice in, and you'll just be blown away by reading Article 1. So Article 1 in almost every state constitution is where they put rights. Professor Amar pointed out the states at the founding, a lot of them had Declaration of Rights. By today, they all have Declaration of Rights, what they're usually called, sometimes Bill of Rights. And you'll see there not just many of the familiar provisions from Bill of Rights and 14th Amendment, but you'll see a lot of unique ones, and then you'll see a lot of ones that say free exercise, but has a right to conscience. So right there, different words, different meaning, and more words, often more meaning. History, culture can often be a great explanation for a state court to chart a different path. I mean, think of states like Utah, Rhode Island, Maryland, Pennsylvania, founded by religious dissenters. It would be really strange for them not to think of that history in construing their free exercise clause and potentially construing it in a more muscular way than, say, the U.S. Supreme Court did in Smith. Probably the biggest, and I think I'll end here because I don't want to go too much beyond my 10 minutes, but probably the biggest area is just fundamental disagreement between state court and high court. But I would point out very legitimate explanations for disagreement. Why would there be legitimate explanations for disagreement about constitutional guarantees, state, federal? One would be a lot of the words we fight the most about in court are in a very high level of generality. What process is due? When is a search unreasonable? What speech is free? I mean, those kind of general terms demand disagreement. It would be incredibly odd, it seems to me, to have them all mean the same thing for the whole country in 51 constitutions. So that's one good one. Here's an even better one. This applies in half the cases. Judges, appellate judges in particular, take methods of interpretation seriously. We're not perfect. We don't always follow them consistently, but we do our best, and we do care about it. And for all the labels out there about constitutional interpretation, I would basically say federal con law cases break down into just two categories. On one side, you've got formal, fixed meaning, textualist, original public meaning, roughly. On the other side, more fluid, more evolving, more informal, more purposivist. That basically is all of federal con law. Why is it worth identifying that? Well, if the precedent at the federal level happens to be a more formal, let's say, originalist precedent, and you happen to be arguing in an informal court, a court that embraces living constitutionalism, is lex textual, You've just established that the federal precedent is presumptively wrong, right? If they take methods of interpretation, they should think it's presumptively wrong. The last reason for disagreement is, let's face it, some areas of federal con law, I mean, bankrupt seemed a little strong for a federal judge to say, but it did come to mind. And I'll give you an illustration of one that I think is at least one you ought to be skeptical of if you've got a client for whom the federal doctrine doesn't do you any favors. You know, think of tiers of review and how that's just kind of grown and evolved. You know, it started as two, and then we had intermediate, then we had rational basis plus. We now have a professor that says we have seven tiers of review. You know, in a way, it looks legitimate. It's almost biblical, right? I mean, on the first day, God gave us rational basis. On the second day, he gave us intermediate scrutiny. But at some point, you know, the tiers of review don't seem to have any clothes, and we ought to acknowledge it. And it turns out there's a lot of other options. There's balancing. There's class legislation, which was the model in the 19th century. So it seems to me that there are often some really good explanations for getting the court to chart a different path. My last point is, how is all of this good? How is federalism, independent state court interpretations of state constitutions, good for federal con law? And I think that's actually really important. Well, first of all, if you're an originalist, it would be very strange not to pay attention to state constitutions. In fact, I don't know how you can do originalism without paying attention particularly to state constitutions with the trial and error between 1776 and 1786. I mean, all of the key guarantees in the federal document come from one and often several state documents. So, you know, see Heller to kind of confirm that point, that you really do need to account for that. But the second point is the Brandeis model, and this is one that really applies across world views, and I think is one of the few things about federalism that we all still embrace collectively. And that's that, you know, if you have a difficult problem, why experiment all at once with one country, 330 million people, 51 sovereigns, and God knows how many local governments? Way better to let a smaller territory government do the experimentation, and if it works, the idea can spread. And occasionally, the idea doesn't spread because there's no one good answer. When Brandeis was speaking, he was speaking of state legislators as the laboratories of experimentation. And another way to think about Brandeis's insight is we ought to be doing the same thing with federal con law. That instead of a top-down model, we race to DC, winner take all. I mean, it's really great when it happens and you constitutionalize something you really love, but it leads to a lot of resentment when the opposite happens. And by doing ground up the way we do legislation and do ground up for development, particularly of, you know, constitutional interpretation of very general terms or worst of all, substantive due process, it does seem to me a ground up approach is gonna improve the US Supreme Court decision. It's gonna lower the resentment because a lot of states will already be doing that. And you know, the odds are probably a little higher that you're gonna get to a good outcome. And I think the Brandeis model leaves one other possibility, which is one I wish we would embrace a little more in America circa 2022, which is uniformity is in everything. There are a lot of areas right now of public policy where there's a lot of very legitimate reasons for taking a different path. And one virtue of federalism is it allows local governments, whether state or cities, to embrace one approach to something without imposing it on their neighbors. And I sometimes think we've lost that message. So thanks for inviting me, and I can't wait to hear Justice Liu.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here at UVA and at the Federalist Society Student Symposium. Thank you for having me. I thought I'd begin with a bit of biography as well, just like Judge Sutton did. So it was fun to listen to Akhil Amar, among other panelists, in the previous session and yesterday as well. I saw him online. He was one of my professors when I was in law school. That's what happens when Akhil became a professor at age 26. but in any event, I was reminded of law school curriculum and, of course, how heavily focused on federal law it is. And what did I do? Of course, I became a constitutional law professor and taught the canonical stuff that you learn in constitutional law. So how is it that I now sit on a state court dealing with state law and appearing on panels about federalism and such? Well, it's kind of interesting. I'll just tell you a little story apropos of, I think, Governor Youngkin's injunction to you to consider state government. So when I graduated from law school, much like many of you perhaps, I studied for the bar that summer, and I took the usual bar review class. It was Barbary back then. I don't know, you guys have Themis now or some other names. Anyway, so it was kind of interesting because, you know, I went to Yale and didn't learn any law, so I was like, wow, you know, this is so eye-opening. You know, there are actually, you know, real rules and things like that that can be crystallized and you can learn them. So anyway, I was having a swimmingly good time studying for the bar. And then, you know, midway through the course, they give you this practice exam around the, you know, July 4th period to norm you across the other test takers, so you kind of know where you stand. And I took this, you know, without, I didn't review or anything, because I really wanted to know, like, how much studying I needed to do in the month of July to get to the, to get to pass the bar. So I took this exam, and then had a nice July 4th weekend and came back the next Monday. And then they give you instantaneously your scorecard, and they give you subject by subject where you are percentile-wise, you know, in the country. So I'll never forget this. Constitutional law, right, 73rd percentile or something like that. I was like, okay, that's pretty good. You know, didn't study, 73rd. And of course, it's a Yale law specialty, you know. Key Lamar taught me well, et cetera. But then I looked at contracts. I was not in the 73rd percentile. I was not in the 50th percentile. I was not in the 25th percentile. I kid you not, the number next to contracts was 3. I was in the 3rd percentile nationally. And you know, 3 is not even a good score on the advanced placement exams in high school. And it was much the same for these other common law subjects, torts, you know, property. I think evidence was on them as a statutory subject, but I didn't learn that either. I was in the teens or low 20s. But sure enough, I did get my act together and study for the bar, and I did pass in that administration. Yes. So I tell you this story to say, from humble origins, you too can become a state Supreme Court justice just like me. But it's a funny story because, you know, it is indicative, actually, in a certain way, of how we are educated. And I'm sure your scores will be better than that. But nonetheless, it's an orientation, right? And it's taken me kind of a little journey to kind of get to this point. So what I want to do is just make a few comments and save the rest really for discussion, but just to situate, you know, the way in which this conversation enters the picture kind of intellectually across time. And it's impossible to talk about this subject without kind of going back 45 years to Justice William Brennan's article in 1977, Harvard Law Review, about individual rights and state constitutions. Some of you will know this article because it is one of the 10 most cited articles of all time. You should note that it was only 16 pages long. So those of you who are in Law Review, take note, 16 pages, right? The most impactful, one of the most impactful 16 pages, actually rivaling one of the Holmes articles, I think The Path of the Law, 22 pages or something like that, also very well cited. So anyway, a lot of words to ideas ratio kept to a very low number. But Brennan's article was that was a call for state courts to step up essentially on the enforcement of individual rights against what he saw as the retrenchment of the post-Warren U.S. Supreme Court retrenching on certain rights. And so the article, you know, definitely had a certain valence to it. It was politically liberal. It was about maximizing individual rights protections. And, you know, it unabashedly cited, 36 dissents that Justice Brennan himself had authored in various individual rights decisions, and he was basically saying to state courts, would you please take a look at these issues in these cases anew under your state constitutions? And by the way, I wrote 36 dissents, in this. So I think this thesis has always had a little bit of induced a little bit of skepticism because of this significant work tilting this issue in a liberal direction and thinking of state constitutionalism as essentially kind of like a one-way liberal ratchet, right? And then that led to a bevy of scholarship and judicial kind of head-scratching about, what is this? Like, is this just kind of, stalking horse, essentially, for liberal individual rights maximalism? Okay. Well, I think, Jeff's work, among others, but I think I really do want to credit Jeff with being just a tremendous intellectual force in this area. Those of us who are consumers, actually, of books like his really get a lot out of it. Is helping us think about this in a much deeper and more historically accurate way, which is to say that state constitutionalism and the role of state courts is a structural feature, right, of our constitutional order, and not necessarily, a tilting one way or the other. And what I want to say about this is, if you just think very instrumentally, if you were an individual rights maximalist, and I think Jeff's book teases, original book, the 51 Imperfect Solutions book teases this out, just think about, is it the best strategy, right, to go straight to the U.S. Supreme Court with, all your favorite rights, as opposed to thinking, and he poses this in the context of the exclusionary rule, as in addition to the school funding cases, is less more, less from the federal level opens up more ability for states and locales to handle these things, because when you federalize things, you can get quite watered down versions of what you were hoping for. You take a federalism discount because the U.S. Supreme Court is wary, right, of imposing a single solution, and so you get under-enforcement of certain kinds of rights. In the context of the exclusionary rule, one might argue, and not just Jeff, but scholars like Bill Stuntz and others have argued about the hydraulic mechanisms, right, between rights and remedies. If you increase a certain remedy, you'll get a cutback on the substantive rights, right? Because a remedy is seen as so severe that you don't want to trigger it in as many instances, right? So, these are very nuanced kinds of determinations. So going straight to the Supreme Court, not always the best thing. Secondly, even if there is going to be a national solution imposed on a particular kind of problem because, it calls for it, state constitutionalism and perhaps federalism more generally is a way of pacing that process, right? We have seen this in a whole bunch of different areas, but percolation, right, of arguments, refinement through that process, the political effects, right, of getting people used to certain kinds of ideas, right? We can debate things like, for example, the same-sex marriage decisions and how they progressed, right? But that is perhaps an example, of how pacing occurs. For some people, it was too fast, maybe a little too slow. But in any event, you can see how mechanisms like that, right, kind of create a timetable for change, right? So that's important to think about. And then third, perhaps what comes out most clearly in the kind of revamped thesis, as opposed to Justice Brennan's version of it, is that this need not either be politically liberal or conservative, because, individual rights is not really a conservative or a liberal notion. We think of Warren Court individual rights as somewhat liberal, but today, I think the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, takings, or in some people's views, economic due process, some people view these as somewhat conservative notions. And federalism, as far as these structural precepts go, should generally be agnostic towards, you know, whether it's liberal or conservative in these ways. It's a structural feature that is meant to create a process through which all these rights can be discussed and acted upon by the various courts. So I think, you know, I just give you this as a way of orienting us to where we are in the conversation, from where we started historically to the present day. And I think I'll stop there. There's much more to say, but thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much to the Federalist Society for organizing and hosting this symposium on the Federalists versus the Anti-Federalists, a subject that I regard as both timely and timeless, and for including me in this roundtable discussion of 21st century federalism. I too went to Yale Law School, and I too was not adequately prepared for the bar exam. And I too realized it about the time of the July 4th weekend. And I was given some very sage advice, which I will pass on to all of you, which was, in addition to trying to catch up a bit with some of these common law subjects, to just keep writing, no matter what, and to make sure that whatever I wrote, it was internally consistent. I did that, and it worked out well. So that is a bar exam tip. Now, in my judgment, getting back to federalism, we're living in an unusually dynamic time with respect to the relationship between the state governments and the federal government. And I am watching developments right now in several areas, which my co-panelists have touched on a little bit, but I'd like to go into a bit more depth, watching several areas with particular interest. First area of interest concerns property rights, specifically the respective roles of state courts and federal courts in adjudicating takings claims. In Nick v. Township of Scott, decided in 2019, the Supreme Court overruled its 1985 precedent, William County v. Hamilton Bank, under which many takings claims were treated as unripe until the property owner had unsuccessfully sought just compensation in the state courts. The theory was, apparently, that the Constitution only addressed property rights deprivations when compensation was found to be lacking. The aggrieved property owner could, to be sure, petition for Supreme Court review of the state court determination. But in a 2005 case, San Remo Hotel v. San Francisco, the Supreme Court made it clear that, in general, preclusion would bar the property owner from bringing a subsequent action in the federal courts. This quickly got referred to as a catch-22 for property owners. And eventually, the Supreme Court addressed the situation in Nick, holding that a property owner may immediately resort to federal court without having to first seek compensation in state court. In my view, the outcome in Nick v. Township of Scott is very much of a piece with other property rights decisions that we've been seeing from the Roberts Court, which taken together can be understood to signify that property rights will no longer be neglected, or maybe, I should say, will at the very least be somewhat of a less neglected constitutional right than they have been in recent decades. But this development, of course, raises a host of questions. With respect to Nick, it's clear that the court has now expanded the role of the lower federal courts in the area of takings claims. But it is as yet unclear how these federal courts are going to handle the possible influx of takings claims. There are a number of hard and important questions relating to, among other things, the respective competencies of state and federal judges. We ask these questions a lot, of course, in the area of all federal constitutional rights, but they have, I think, particular complexity in the area of property rights, which are, of course, largely, but not entirely, the product of state law. And there are, of course, a lot of questions about the prudent use of the resources of the federal courts. As Jeff noted, there are a lot more federal judges a lot more state judges than federal judges, right? State court cases just dwarf federal court cases. And so how are federal courts going to ensure that their resources are deployed expertly. There are, of course, abstention doctrines, but the abstention doctrines that are now in existence seem, at least to me, to be a somewhat poor fit. So there will be questions as to whether these doctrines will be applied, or whether perhaps the federal courts will craft special abstention doctrines in the area of takings. Second area of interest also involves property rights. This one relates to the limits of government power to exercise eminent domain. Eminent domain has been viewed as an inherent property of sovereignty. You see eminent domain power exercised at all levels of the government, federal, state, and local. You also see eminent domain power delegated to private entities, most prominently utility companies. In the wake of the 2005 Supreme Court decision in Kelo v. City of New London, one of the most unpopular decisions in the history of the Supreme Court, the action shifted to the states. Justice Stevens, author of the Kelo majority opinion, had said in both his majority opinion in Kelo and also later on in public speeches responding to public outrage after the decision was released, if you don't like this, you can always resort to the political process. And so a number of people did. Most of the responses were at the state level. So we saw a lot of state laws and also some amendments to state constitutions. But dissatisfaction remains. A lot of these measures at the state level, including a lot of amendments to state constitutions, have been criticized as being anemic, as having enormous carve-outs for, among other things, blight. And the burdens of eminent domain, or so many argue, continue to fall disproportionately on those who do not have significant economic and political power. So what is to be done? Is it possible that we will see the federal courts get involved again? IJ and other public interest law firms, perhaps, will find a test case, and so forth. If ever a precedent looked by the standards that Supreme Court justices have recently articulated when telling us what makes a precedent particularly vulnerable to overruling, Kelo does seem to fit the bill. In any event, I am quite fascinated and was very delighted when Jeff published his books that make it clear that there is this dynamic relationship. It's not that things flow one way or the other. We see things bounce back and forth with the states, between the states and the federal government. Third area of interest is economic liberties, in particular occupational licensing, a live controversy that predated the COVID-19 emergency. And of course, when we think about economic liberties, thinking about the government responses to the COVID-19 emergency, which has, of course, generated an enormous amount of litigation at the state and federal level. And we think, of course, about what are the limits to government power at the federal level, and, of course, the limits of the police powers of the state and local governments. The greater solicitude that we have been seeing for property rights suggests to me that the so-called New Deal settlement, under which, roughly speaking, by the end of the New Deal era, it appeared that courts were going to get almost entirely out of the business, or at least they claimed they would get almost entirely out of the business, of overseeing bread and butter state economic and social legislation. And so we had in 1955, Williamson v. Lee Optical, which Jeff just mentioned. We had the year before Williamson v. Lee Optical, Berman v. Parker, an eminent domain case where the court, a unanimous Supreme Court for Justice Douglas, said that public use is pretty much coterminous with whatever the legislature thinks might be a good idea. I mean, sure, there might be an exception if there was some blatant corruption and so forth, but it was pretty much about as close to being a rubber stamp as I think the court has ever gotten. So one result of that, of course, is that in trying to get some kind of economic liberty claim into federal it is common for litigants to resort to other constitutional claims, in particular the First Amendment. Through the operation of constitutional hydraulics, the race is on to fashion claims, and we have seen a great deal of this in the litigation over government responses to COVID-19, to not come into court and say, look, there are limits to the police power. Sure, they can respond to the COVID-19 emergency. This is a pandemic. But they can't do the following things in terms of closing down businesses. But we don't see those sorts of arguments. Instead, we see things cast as First Amendment claims and so on and so forth. I've been interested for a long time in whether or not the growing solicitude for property rights would spill over into economic liberties in general. And I've been particularly interested in this as I've seen state constitutions, interpretations of state constitutions, show a greater consideration, more openness for economic liberty claims. In the area of property rights, we have seen interpretations of state constitutions turn out to be influential in the Supreme Court when it comes to interpretations of the federal constitution. And so I am watching carefully to see if we will have things along those lines. And finally, I am thinking, of course, a lot about the Dobbs case and about what the landscape of American federalism may look like after Dobbs. Should this court uphold the Mississippi law at issue in Dobbs, we will see a great deal of activity on the state level. We already have state laws poised to go into effect. Those will in turn be followed by other legislative actions and so forth. State legislatures, I believe, are very likely going to have to take abortion regulation a bit more seriously in the sense that state legislators will not be able simply to play to their bases. They will have to think carefully and they will have to, I suspect anyway, draft statutes quite a bit more carefully. The Mississippi statute at issue in Dobbs does have some robust carve-outs, or some fairly robust carve-outs for maternal health, significant fetal conditions incompatible with life, et cetera, but not all statutes do. These will, I suspect, also be followed by additional cases. I do not believe that the Supreme Court is going to be able to get out of abortion cases altogether. I believe the Supreme Court can reduce its abortion docket by paying greater attention to standing issues with respect to abortion litigation. But I do think we have to be ready and think very hard about the likely follow-on cases, that we will certainly see challenges, I think, to abortion laws, as applied challenges, at the very least. And there are also on the horizon, I think, challenges to abortion laws that are grounded in the conviction that at some point in pregnancy, the fetus does become a person for constitutional purposes, for reasons that have been well articulated by John Finnis and Robbie George and others. The moral force of these claims, I think, is likely to resonate with a significant portion, maybe even a majority, it's very hard to know, of the United States electorate. So anyway, I have talked, I think, for long enough, so I will stop now, and I very much look forward to comments and questions.
Great, thank you all for that. I was just thinking that I guess I'm lucky to be on this panel because I don't live in a state and I work on a circuit that doesn't oversee any states. And I guess I am grateful that Jeff considers it to be 51 perfect solutions, but perfect solutions. So yeah. So I guess I get counted in DC that way. I clerked here in Charlottesville for Judge Wilkinson, and I think that was a real education in federalism, just living in the Commonwealth of Virginia itself, where people take federalism relatively seriously. And I remember we would sometimes go to the Jefferson Hotel in Richmond, and there's a statue there of Thomas Jefferson. And on the front, it says Governor of Virginia. And on the side, it says President of the United States, which, you know, I think is just very indicative of the kind of place that this law school is located. But maybe for the discussion, maybe we can just pick up where Julia left off. I don't know, Goodwin and Jeff, if you have some thoughts about what a post-Dobbs world looks like, both with respect to federal and state court litigation. I'm not sure if that's something you'd like to say something about. Jeff, you mentioned it a little bit in your remarks.
Well, I mean, there's, the more in any area, the more the U.S. Supreme Court constitutionalizes, occupies the field, the less there is to do. And the less they're doing that, the more there is to do. I think it's not overly cynical to say that for a long time under Roe and Casey, state legislative activity was really symbolic. And you know, the votes that were cast were not real votes because, again, the court had occupied so much of the field. So to the extent Dobbs and earlier decisions show it's occupying less, I totally agree with Julia that, I mean, you already have this. You already have state court cases. In fact, you know, there's one case that kind of illustrates a dynamic about federalism that it's worth paying attention to. One, don't assume a state court that's in a red or a blue state is equally red or blue. So Kansas Supreme Court has a decision, natural law-based decision that probably goes beyond Roe, you know, maybe goes beyond Casey, maybe even Roe, in protecting a right to abortion. We think of that as a fairly conservative state, and yet that's what the majority of the Kansas Supreme Court did. But the other feature of that case that's worth pointing out is, let me just step back for a second. If I had to put my finger on one thing about federal con law that drives me to drink, it is that the U.S. Supreme Court is arguably the court in world history that has embraced judicially enforceable rights more than any other. And I consider it our fault, not theirs. We love this, all right? So we've got a court that has embraced judicially enforceable rights more than any other, and yet it is a court that can't be checked. So I don't know that there's a constitution in the world, maybe Australia, but I don't think there's a constitution in the world that is harder to amend than ours. So a conventional way to check a decision you don't care for, the people don't care for, would be to amend, and we've kind of lost. We don't amend anymore. That's not, we used to do that, we don't do that anymore, and it's the three-quarters requirement. And the second option would be to replace the judges, and that's very difficult to do with life tenure. It's just a game of chance. And so we have this really strange combination, which I frankly think is not sustainable, of a court that embraces judicially enforceable rights more than any other, and yet you can't check it. That is conspicuously not the case at the states. And it's one reason I am such an advocate of state courts as the first responders, the initial voice in the dialogue about when we innovate rights to deal with new norms. And so I mentioned this in connection with Kansas because Kansas, after its Kansas Supreme Court wrote this decision under the Kansas Constitution, there's now an initiative. Oh, actually, I'm not sure it's an initiative, but there is now going to be a constitutional vote, I think this fall, whether the Kansas Constitution should be amended to check the court decision. Now, I'm not taking sides, believe it or not, on that issue. I'm trying to make a different point, that the people have a little more authority there. And one reason experimentation at the state court level is a safer idea than at the federal level is there's so many checks. If they get over their skis too far, the people can respond. At the federal level, they just can't. And you know, I think Abet Goodwin agrees with me on this, and Naomi as well. The longer you're a judge, the more you focus on risk of error. And the risk of error at the U.S. Supreme Court in constitutionalizing is very, very high. It is not nearly as high at the state level, which is a reason I think state court judges, I don't want to say liberated, but have a little more flexibility. So I also think it'll be really interesting what happens in state legislatures. You could see some state legislatures in conservative states kind of going full bore, protecting a right to life, but then seeing political consequences they've not seen before. And that could lead to forms of compromise. And you know, if there's one thing I think that's really missing in this area, and I know I'm speaking to a lot of people with deep convictions about this issue, and you have deep convictions about something, compromise sounds like you're compromising, you know, say ethics, for example. So I really appreciate the point. But we still do live in a democracy, right? And we live in a world where it's pluralistic and we really do have to respect. And sometimes compromise is the only way to deal with really, really difficult issues. And this has been a difficult issue. How can you say it hasn't been for 50 years? So maybe more compromise occurs and maybe there's more stability and maybe there's less resentment.
I won't add a whole lot, except to say that maybe this question is a good vehicle to illustrate actually some of the structural precepts that we've been talking about. So, just speaking from my home jurisdiction, you know, California I believe, already recognizes a right to abortion under the state constitution. And I'm fairly certain that our legislature will have some reaction if the court rules, as Professor Mahoney suggests it might. So yes, I mean, these state-level responses are in the offing. I would also point out, apropos of Jeff's suggestion to you to go read a state constitution, that if you read the California Constitution, you will see that it expressly protects a right to privacy. The word privacy is textually mentioned, and it is its own provision in the California Constitution, and there is an entire set of doctrine built on that phrase, right? So there are just certain features of state constitutions that don't exist in the federal, and those are important differences. And last, to this point, Jeff mentioned about difficulty of amending. You know, it's a good entree to perhaps, you know, maybe you're interested in some of this conversation about differences between state judges and federal judges in terms of electoral accountability, as well as the easiness to amend the state constitutions. You know, on one view, right, the point of electoral accountability and the more kind of direct democracy kind of tether that judges may face in the state systems is meant to perhaps keep them on a shorter leash, right? That's part of the notion there. But on the other hand, what Jeff is alluding to is the notion that, well, you know, if we err, right, in making constitutional decisions, they are less difficult to overrule, just like statutory decisions are less difficult to overrule. And so in that sense, right, the costs, the risk, the perceived risk and costs of these errors is arguably less. Which, you know, which of these influences, you know, is more dominant and cashes out? We can talk about kind of the psychology of judging, the norms of judging, and maybe that's a good, you know, topic for, you know, a future round of questions. But I would just say that, you know, your question points out, you know, these structural features.
Mm-hmm. If we have questions from the audience, I certainly have plenty of questions, but is there a microphone or?
I think Julia.
Oh, sorry. No, please go ahead.
Yeah, Julia. Audience question. No, you could hear.
Hi. Thank you very much for being here today. So commentators have usually characterized the relationship between federal and state law by saying that federal law is interstitial to state law. Given the ever-expanding scope of federal regulation, do you think that that characterization is still true today?
I'll just jump in, but real quickly. I mean, if a national government can do everything, there's not a lot of room to fill gaps. There are no gaps by definition. And, you know, one of the things that I think is, you know, it doesn't prove what's right about the Commerce Clause, but one of the things that just so surprises me that we don't consider when we have Commerce Clause cases and we're debating whether the Congress has this authority is we think of it just in the sense of the law they're proposing. Like, and so, you know, if it's a pandemic-related law or it's a law designed to deal with this problem or that problem, and so we very quickly shift to, should we nationalize that policy? And that's a healthy debate, right? Should it be nationalized or should we have local variation? But what people forget about those Commerce Clause debates is the power to regulate is the power to preempt. Once you say they can regulate an area, they can wipe out everything in that area at the state level. And so that's, so even put it to the side of the constitutional, think about it from a wisdom perspective of Congress. You know, you really have to think twice before you decide this is our area, because it means if it is your area and the U.S. Supreme Court upholds it, a later Congress can come in and not just do something similar to what you did, but they could actually flip it and nullify everything at the state level. And I feel like we should, every time you say power to regulate, the power to preempt should go within five words, because that's really important. And I think I take your question to be, is with the growth of the the federal government, growth of federal agencies, there's less room to experiment. It's undeniable.
I would just add to that, you know, at least would Congress preempt state law, there's some political checks because, you know, there are representatives who come from certain states, and at least in theory, maybe they represent some federalism interests, although that is increasingly less the case. But agencies often preempt state law without any direct say-so from Congress. And so often that preemption power is sort of implicit in these open-ended delegations. And so you just have, you know, you have people working in D.C. who really have almost no federalism check deciding what should be preempted. And that makes the problem even worse.
Well, now that a person from a territory is dominating the conversation and bringing it back into administrative law, I just have to say one thing, which I really want to say. I'm smiling when I said everything I just said. One of the things that's amazing about an agency, so a broad delegation to an agency by Congress, broad authority by the agency to regulate the area, very big deal. What's really significant about that and striking is that we have the government of the 51 with the most power has the least restrictions when it comes to an enforceable non-delegation doctrine, unless your law was passed in 1935. We still have Chevron, where the agency has final say over reasonable interpretations of the statute. Guess what this allows? This allows the agency to circumvent administrative law procedures and restrictions at the state level. Only two states embrace Chevron. Only 10 of the 50 states have some kind of deference to interpretations of law. 43 of the 50 states vigorously enforce non-delegation. So you not just have the problem that Naomi mentioned, that the agency is doing the regulation and the preempting of state work, they're end running what the state would normally do as a matter of administrative law, not allow a big policy delegation to the agency and not allow the agency the final say over the meaning of the statute. It's like triply, quadruply evading. It's really significant.
There's really no end to like which the problems are that are worse,
well, right?
Right? Yeah, you just keep going, yeah.
I was going to say, yes, I think it's an enormous problem, but I also see a lot of activity to cut it back. There is talk of, if not getting rid of Chevron, at least significantly modifying Chevron. There's the major questions doctrine, which of course is I think, doing a great deal, has the potential to do a great deal of work in this issue and in this area. More on the lots of possibilities for developments at the federal level on the non-delegation front, and of course, possibilities for the Supreme Court to further delineate the precise contours of Congress's powers, particularly its powers under the Commerce Clause. So when I see activity on a number of fronts, it seems to me that there's a recognition of a potential significant problem, but also responses to it.
I'll just add extremely briefly that there are many adjectives that could describe federal law today, but interstitial is not one of them. That's just a purely descriptive statement from where I sit on a state court at the nexus of a lot of state and federal law issues. I express no view on whether that's good or bad. I mean, I take the law as it comes, but I don't think it can be described as interstitial. It's a very crowded field. And I mean, I come from a state where we have a very active legislature. So on every topic, right, there's a jockeying between state and federal. We have a lot of preemption issues, and you know that is just the reality, I think, today.
In a lot of important regulatory spheres, California is almost a kind of counterweight to federal regulation in a lot of areas, mm-hmm. just because of its sheer size.
Hi, thank you for being here. I have two questions. The first is for Justice Liu. So something that frustrates me when I research candidates for state legislatures is that often they run on a platform of protecting federal constitutional rights. So for example, in my home state, people will run to say that they're gonna protect the Second Amendment, and I get it, you know, it's a way of saying, you know, vote for me, I'm pro-gun.
But in my opinion, they really should be asking people, or they really should be telling people, I'm going to protect Article 2, Section 26 of our state constitution. So how do we educate the public, or you know, get the word out about state constitutional rights? And then for Judge Sutton, sometimes federal judges strike down state laws or even state constitutional amendments or overrule state Supreme Court decisions. And so from your perspective, do federal courts do this too much, and does it take away our ability to govern ourselves?
Can we go first? Sure. Well, great questions. The very initial answer I have to your question is you should take Jeff Sutton's course on state constitutionalism. I mean, what I mean by that is, you know, I don't know, Jeff, if you're doing this, but you should develop, you know, a module that other professors, right, can take and teach and propagate. Jeff teaches a marvelous course both at Ohio State and I think at Harvard. And this is not part of the regular curriculum, and it begins really with all of you. I mean, if the people of the profession, right, don't know this, how can we expect the general public to know this? And I mean, there are many critiques, including in, you know, the works of folks here about just lawyers not knowing, you know, their way around the law, because this is not the orientation that we've been given in our legal education. So I think that is just the starting point, is knowing, to make these arguments and developing them. And, you know, I mean, on the judge side, there is, I think, a lot of utility to having a judicial education that's also focused on this, because it's not so much that we don't know these provisions exist, but I think it goes to the arguments about lockstepping, which is a jargon term for the notion that state judges, when they interpret these state constitutional provisions, simply tether them, right, to the U.S. Supreme Court's interpretation of the analogous federal provisions, right, instead of independently thinking about what these provisions might mean. And this, I mean, I'll just say, as a matter of kind of professional orientation, is just a, the easiest way to describe it is I always give the story of the person who's looking for lost keys in a parking lot on a dark night and is looking under a lamppost. And then the person, the passerby, says, "Oh, did you lose your keys there?" And they say, "No, but the light is better over here," right? I mean, the point is, judges go to where the law is, right? And the U.S. Supreme Court is prolific, as you know, as Jeff's been telling us. And so, on so many issues, state judges just turn first to like where the law is, and they look authoritative. It's published, whatever, you know. And judges are generally quite cautious people. They're a small c conservative by nature, and they don't like to strike out in new directions, right? So they're just cautiously trying to, you know, put themselves into the whatever the mainstream view is. Well, you know, my argument, which I've made many times, is I think this is a mistake from a constitutional structure point of view, right? The reason we have this redundancy in interpretation authority in our Constitution is because we expect these people to take a fresh look. Why else would we have this redundancy? There are lots of things that are redundant in the Constitution. That's for a reason, right? We want people to have competing, contending, independent views so as to be a little bit, you know, checks and balances. Maybe it's a little inefficient. I mean, our Constitution is not written for efficiency, right? So to take this redundancy seriously means, I think, to have these kind of independent looks, which requires, I think, to your question, a change in orientation about norms. And that's quite hard to achieve, but it's through, you know, having more forums like this. I'm the only state judge here, at this conference, right? I mean, Joan Larson was going to join us. She was a state judge.
I should have mentioned that.
Yes. Josh, we miss her presence. Yeah. But, you know, that's indicative in a way. I'm not saying, you know, I mean, but next time you have the conference, you know, consider, you know, might there not be, if not 50-50, some sort of balance between, you know, the state and the federal, indicative of, you know, the nature of this discussion.
Yeah, I mean, in a word, I do think the footprint of the federal courts is too big. The question is where and why. One reason I think we all write is, even though we have day jobs which require a lot of other writing, is to kind of make sure we're being consistent across the way. And in this new book, Who Decides, the first four chapters are all on this issue. And the one thing, if you're an originalist, the one thing the original public meaning I think is clear is judicial review is appropriate by federal judges. It didn't take John Marshall, it didn't take Murray versus Madison, it didn't take the election of 1800. If none of those things would have happened, we would still have judicial review in this country. And that's because of the state court decisions interpreting the early state constitutions. It was accepted. The one other lesson, though, at the same time we federal judges do have this authority, it's really clear that they were careful about it. It wasn't the Thayer presumption of constitutionality. It was actually duty. You have a duty to strike, when there's a superior law constitution, you have a duty to strike the inferior law. But they were very careful about a conflict. And, you know, for those of you skeptical of constitutional avoidance, boy, that technique was used a lot by the state courts. So, you know, and, you know, John McGinnis, you heard last night, has this article, Duty of Clarity, which says you, using principles of interpretation, you ought to have a clear rule that emerges that shows that there really is a conflict where the superior law has to be recognized as a matter of duty. I just wonder, maybe we've gotten a little away from that. But, you know, the hardest question for federal judges today and a very hard question for originalists is, originalists have this double problem that their 1789 original public meaning was not honored, and suddenly a 1961 decision is sacrosanct. That's fixed, right? The 1789 Constitution's not fixed. That's allowed to evolve, but the 1961 decision, don't touch it. That's sacrosanct, you know, handed down. You know, so that's tricky. And one way, I think, to deal with that, you know, Justice Thomas has a clear approach to it, but it also has one vote, and I don't know how many more it's going to get. But one way to think about the problem of subtracting or adding rights that aren't in the Constitution, and when do you correct the problem, is paying attention to the states. And there's some federal constitutional rulings that have held, and you really do have 3/4 of the people, so it's kind of like a non-prejudicial error at this point, because there really would be 3/4 support for it, which is the thing that's been evaded, 3/4 of the states. But there are other federal rulings where, no, that's not true. We're still stuck in something way less than 3/4. And that can be helpful insight as to when, you know, stare decisis is not controlling, and it's time to revisit.
Thank you all for coming today. So my question is relating to, it seems that a theme of much of y'all's discussion on property rights versus Second Amendment rights relates to striking down state action against an individual citizen, which sounds great to many of us. However, not all of us are libertarian. And my question is, how ought state courts or state legislatures to innovate in a way that's not directly violative of the Supremacy Clause in areas in which the states would like to act more? And here I'm thinking of states' actions as it relates to Roe v. Wade or other types of decisions like that.
Well, I think we're going to see that for sure. And we're going to see, I hope, more sophisticated and honest and substantive public discussions about the possibility that there are often two lives at issue with abortion regulation. And I absolutely take your point that not everyone is a libertarian, although I would emphasize to you that you don't have to be a libertarian to think that having limited government powers is absolutely essential for the functioning of a society. Others?
that Will? Is that, are you from Columbus? Yes. Go. We got Ohio here. Excellent. Great question. He already knows my answer.
First of all, thank you so much for giving us your time. My question specifically is for Judge Sutton when you were speaking about the Supreme Court putting up stop signs, essentially, and how we need to go to state courts and state legislative systems to try to deal with that. I'm just wondering, but in certain situations, isn't that essentially a Band-Aid? I know you mentioned Smith specifically, and I'm thinking of more recent jurisprudence like Fulton, on issues like that, and I'm just wondering, when we're seeing cases like this in states with things like RFRAs and like on the books, is it really enough for us to say that states can protect the rights when the Supreme Court puts up these stop signs, or do we need to do something to get these stop signs down in some way?
Well, I don't think they're mutually exclusive. One explanation for the court to remove, the U.S. Supreme Court to remove a stop sign is either evidence in the state courts, if it's an originalist U.S. Supreme Court justice, evidence in the state courts showing they got it wrong. If you're an evolving constitutionalist, shifting norms can be evidence in the state courts that you got it wrong in that way. So they're not mutually exclusive. You know, I get your point. I'm not sure I'd say a Band-Aid. I mean, I would say you either want the protection in that jurisdiction or you don't. I mean, as long as the stop sign's there, the pragmatic answer is you have to do something if you care about it. Now, RFRA is a really interesting example of your point where people are inclined to say, oh, it's just a statute. Is that as good as a constitution? I think this is a legend and myth of American public policy. If I had to pick between Brown versus Board of Education, the 1964 Civil Rights Act, I would always take the 64 Civil Rights Act because it's the goal. The goal is to have a majority of citizens protecting a minority. That's what we want. We don't want 9 or 5 having to do it. That's a tragedy. And RFRA, I mean, I don't know if Professor McConnell's still here, but ask Professor McConnell this question. And I like aligning with him on protecting religious liberties. I think you get that point. I think he would say at the federal level, the federal RFRA is probably more dependable at the U.S. Supreme Court than free exercise. Why would, and I definitely say that, maybe I should say that, emphasize that, but I think he agrees with me. Why might that be? Because federal judges who are worried about risks of error are liberated with a statute. They say, it says strict scrutiny. We're demanding strict scrutiny. And that's what they did under RFRA. And I think when they're thinking, what if we overshoot in construing free exercise? The people have no recourse when we're constitutionalizing. So, you know, I hear your point about statutes, but I sometimes think we don't give them the respect they deserve. And just think 64 Civil Rights Act, that's a really important milestone in American government. And for us, Brown versus Board of Education, that's what the citizenry knows. It's a great decision, of course, but the 64 Civil Rights Act, come on, that is so much more superior.
So all this talk about state Supreme Courts kind of being functioning as laboratories of democracy brings me back to particularly Michigan v. Long, where the Michigan kind of went out and did that with respect to Terry stops. And the Supreme Court said, well, the Supreme Court redefined what it means to have an independent state ground in a way. So the bottom line is, are we worried that if states become a little bit too out of line with SCOTUS, that SCOTUS will start fundamentally restricting how much discretion state Supreme Courts have to define their own state constitutions? And furthermore, does that kind of give legitimacy to why we need to turn to legislatures and statute rather than state Supreme Courts at first impression? Thank you.
Well, I mean, so sometimes this happens. I mean, I've had, I, I can actually think of pending cases right now where this is happening, but I can't talk about those. It's really unfortunate because I have like a really good example.
Is it redistricting?
It's actually, well, I don't even want to say it, but the point is that the U.S. Supreme Court, or federal courts more generally, but the U.S. Supreme Court has available to it so many devices, actually, for recasting cases. Think about Fulton, okay? Fulton's actually a good example of this. What is the U.S. Supreme Court doing interpreting a local contract according to Pennsylvania contract principles, rendering an authoritative decision, right, on basically the narrowest, smallest of grounds on which they can't possibly be expert relative to the state courts of Pennsylvania, right? I mean, I think just on a competency perspective, right, who deals with Pennsylvania contract law day in and day out? Not the U.S. Supreme Court, right? But nonetheless, I mean, cases travel, and there are certain imperatives in order to get a majority or to create compromises, and maybe that's in service of some important larger values. But it is indicative, right, of the way in which state law concepts are not entirely hermetically sealed from federal judicial review. And this happens in a variety of areas where, you know, concept A can be said to be to mean one thing under state law, but the federal court will always be able to say, but for purposes of federal law, it doesn't mean the same thing. And there are cases like this which are, you know, essentially overrulings of state courts on what one might think on the surface are matters of state law.
I mean, one just real quick point, there's this misunderstanding that the feds create a ratchet and the state courts can only go above it. That's why everyone's so afraid this is purely libertarian. And I not only want laboratories of experimentation at the state court level, I want a free market. It's not a free market if the negotiation starts at the federal and only goes above. State courts can go as high as they want under the state constitution and that state elevator bank, and as low as they want. They can't go up on the state establishment clause in a way that violates free exercise. Different point. But when they're in that elevator bank, they can go as high or as low as they want. And I gotta say, state court judges don't appreciate this. If they did, half the state courts in this country would probably have said our free speech clause protects speech and not money. We disagree with Citizens United. And another half of our state courts would have said we don't have a substantive due process right to an abortion. Neither has happened, which is absolutely astonishing. And it proves we don't have a free market, and that is, in my view, ignorance. And I don't think it's Michigan versus Long that caused it, for what it's worth. That would be a sign of the end of times that many people understood the doctrine. But that's an education point we've got to do better on.
I actually have a question. I'm curious what you think about this. So the only reason for state courts to innovate on their constitutional law is to open up a policymaking space for state legislatures. And, well, I mean, in part, right? You know, if you want greater establishment clause protections and you can open up, more opportunities for the state government to act. I mean, how much do you think that state courts decline to do that because the federal government on the policy side has occupied so much of the policymaking on some of these areas? So there's not really an incentive for either the state court governments or the state courts to innovate because they've been crowded out, not just on economic issues, but also on a lot of social issues.
I would say you have the exact same dynamic with state courts and state legislatures. The more the national government does, whether it's Congress or the high court, the less the state court or the state legislature is going to see room to exercise authority. The less they do, the opposite happens.
I am curious, though, about why we sometimes see state legislatures acting in symbolic, to use Jeff's, I think, diplomatic term. I would say grandstanding on sensitive issues. And because we do see innovation in that sometimes along those lines. Mm-hmm. So what makes an issue become one that is so symbolic? Is it ease of understanding, public public controversy, some combination?
Linguistic shortcuts. I mean, you know the national language, the Second Amendment, it's a linguistic shortcut is what's going on. You're trying to connect to as many people as possible. It doesn't justify it, but you know, I don't have to run for office, so I probably shouldn't get on too high a horse on this one.
Yes, and just one more thought about federal constitutional rights and state politicians running on them. They do have quite a bit, actually, of influence, I think. The state court judges, the ones who aren't elected, say in Virginia, the General Assembly has an important role to play, and even where state court judges are elected, state politicians are very much involved. So they are, and because state courts, as we've been discussing, are so much more plentiful, they are interpreting federal constitutional rights a great deal. So I don't think state politicians are being completely disingenuous when they brag about how they're going to do something with respect to our federal constitutional rights.
Thank you all for being here. My question stems from Chief Judge Sutton's boiling down of the law to kind of two interpretive areas, with one, original public meaning broadly, and then second, more of a fluid living constitution model. So I guess some of the strongest arguments for more of an original public meaning approach stem precisely from the structural differences mentioned between the state and federal judiciaries, where at the federal level, because federal judges are not elected, have life tenure, the federal constitution is less easily amendable. That sort of counsels more for an original public meaning approach and less experimentation. So when these factors are taken away at the state level, does that mean that state courts should move more towards kind of that second living constitutionalism approach? Or are there still very compelling arguments for judges to still adhere to more of an original public meaning approach?
You kind of started this off a little.
Yeah, but the question was addressed to you.
All right, well, let me start it off, because Goodwin did mention, he was making the point of what are the right norms for state court judging when there's less risk of error, right? Their decisions can be corrected by constitutional amendments, 90% of them have to return to the ballot box. And you know, here's another way to think about this. Living constitutionalism in its most aggressive form doesn't make any sense with state constitutions. And the reason it doesn't make any sense is the same reason no one would have been talking about it in the early 1800s, late 1700s. There was no time for anything to evolve, to live. And at the state level, it's so Jeffersonian. I mean, it's just astonishing to compare the 50 state constitutions and their evolution since 1776 and the lack of evolution. The federal document is still stuck largely in the 18th century. I mean, I would say today, to illustrate the point, the Mississippi and California constitutions have more in common with each other than either does with the federal constitution, which is just amazing when we think about those very different groups of people that live there. And that's because at the state level, you know, the Jacksonian era launches a bunch of amendments. You elect a lot more people, plural executive, Reconstruction, lots of amendments, progressivism, lots of amendments, Baker versus Carr, lots of amendments. And the federal ones just stuck there with amendment by interpretation. Essentially, that's it, with occasional actual amendments. So to me, living constitutional really doesn't make sense. That said, I would focus on one other thing. There's never been a perfect originalist. There's never been a perfect living constitutionalist that perfectly captures the norms of society. All judges make errors. You should be a little more comfortable making an error as a state court judge. So I don't think it liberates you. I do think when you're really in a close place, I think I personally, as a federal judge, would err on the side of democracy. Don't really screw this up. I don't think I would feel quite the same way as a state court judge, because there are a lot of corrective mechanisms.
I really like this question, and I'm going to answer it in a slightly tangential or higher level in a way. many of you are probably interested in clerking, and I guess I'll just say that one interesting thing that I've learned, this is my 11th year on the bench, believe it or not, just been a blink of an eye, but people sometimes ask, what was it like, you know, transitioning from being a professor to being a judge? And as a constitutional law professor, of course, I was very steeped in all of these debates and very interested in them, and I would sit where you're sitting and think of them as so fascinating in terms of how we should actually think about the work of the courts and whatnot. I will tell you that the primary sensation that I have from actually sitting in office is the highly limited relevance of these debates. I hate to burst your bubble, but
You need to wait till the end of the segment.
In this sense, I mean, not that they're not interesting and not that we shouldn't study it. Of course we should. We should all be very careful students of constitutional history. That's why we're here. But from where I sit, I'll just tell you, in the Mine Run case, there is so much precedent to contend with. There is so much that, I mean, frankly, we're a lower court when it comes to many of these issues, right? Federal issues. And so there isn't any impulse to decide whether one is an evolving constitutionalist or originalist or whatever. I assure you that the seven members of my court do not think in these terms. Like, this is not part of the mindset or vocabulary of how cases are decided or how things are interpreted. So anyway, that's just a very pragmatic point about everyday judging. Everyday judging is judging that is in an incredibly crowded thicket of law, you know, straight up law. Forget about these theories, right? It's just law through and through, which is good. I mean, I think it's good because judges are not theorists, nor should we aim to be. The other point I'll make, this is specific to state constitutions, which is also kind of gives you a sense of orientation, is that state constitutions are very crowded documents. And I noticed that Jeff's admonition was that you read the first article of your state constitution, because if you read past the first article, you likely will be kept up late at night, or you may fall asleep, one or the other, right? I just to give you my little thumbnail, I typically think of these state constitutions as having four kinds of provisions, right? The first kind is what some people call legislation in constitutional garb, which essentially provisions that are code. They're just statutory code, but they've been rendered constitutional because it's fairly easy, actually, to constitutionalize measures at the state level. The examples I like to give are, you know, there is a provision of the Alabama Constitution, Amendment 492, which is about the sale of catfish. It's a marketing provision about the sale of catfish. There is a provision of the Florida Constitution, Article 10, I believe Section 21, which is about limitations on the confinement of pigs during pregnancy. I don't think this is what John Marshall was talking about when he said it's the Constitution we're expounding, right? But this is the reality. Actually, if you go down the California Constitution, there is a whole bunch of stuff that is, you know, it is constitutional in the sense that in the hierarchy of laws, it occupies the highest rung and it is accorded that status when it comes time to interpret. But it certainly does not habituate state judges, right, to thinking about these broad stroke issues. It habituates us into thinking about our documents as ordinary law, right? The other three kinds, just to give you the taxonomy, at least as I think of it, are there are state-specific, number two, there are state-specific provisions, right, that don't exist in the federal. So I mentioned the word privacy, for example, in the California Constitution. There are many state constitutions that mention things like rights to education, which is the font, right, for these school funding lawsuits and others, that there is no similar textual hook in the federal constitution. Third kind would be analogous language between state constitutions and federal constitutions, but the state provision has distinctive state history, that distinguishes it, even though textually similar, is meaningfully different because of state history. The example I'd like to give is the jury guarantee in the Sixth Amendment, right, which has been interpreted by the Supreme Court not to extend to petty thefts and misdemeanors. But if you read a very intelligent decision by the Maine Supreme Court, it plumbs the history of the same language in the Massachusetts Constitution, of which Maine used to be a part, right, and says that, yes, it actually does cover misdemeanors according to this very specific state history, right? And then the fourth kind is the analogous provisions between federal and state, for which there is no state-specific history or meaning to be attached. And actually, this to me is the most interesting bucket, right? California, for example, has an equal protection clause. It actually postdates the federal equal protection clause. And I cannot say that there is any state-specific meaning of equal protection in California. Which then raises the interpretive conundrum of...
Are you guys doing tiers of review? Please say no.
Well, I mean, that's a great question. We do have tiers of review, but they're not exactly the same, right? They're not exactly the same as the federal ones. But as I always tell my constitutional law students, you know, the tiers of review, I'm a little bit Posner-esque in this domain. If you read Posner, you know, he'll tell you this is all garbage. But, I mean, you know, the point is watch what courts do, not what they say, right? They say one thing, but watch what they do, what they actually do under the standards, and you will understand what kind of review they are applying, right? Strict scrutiny is sometimes strict, sometimes not, right? But forget the labels, right? Look at what they actually do. So anyway, in this last bucket, I think that the interpretive conundrum arises of what should state courts actually do in giving meaning to this? Should they lockstep, should they not? And that's actually the fertile debate. But, so my long-winded answer to your question is, I don't actually think that in practical effect, people, you know, everyday judges really think in these terms.
I'm not sure I agree, but, so do we have time for one more question? Yeah, maybe one more question?
Thank you for your time and taking this question. With the division that exists in this country right now, and with people mooting topics like national divorce, what is your thoughts on reverting to maybe a version of dual federalism which incorporates the incorporation clauses as a means for that to progress and potentially allow for citizens to choose states which will guarantee their liberties vice those states that may not guarantee their liberties in much the same way. I'm saying that as a refugee from California, for example.
What are you a refugee from?
San Diego.
I'll just say one quick thing. So sometimes this discussion ends right at your point, which I think is possible, but also not the most hopeful one. In other words, will we just have red states and blue states? In other words, we'll have red state courts and blue state courts, even though Jeff says they don't always behave accordingly. But in other words, the red states will do what they do, the blue states will do what they do, and everyone gets, to kind of choose. That's possible, and you see some signs of that. But that doesn't really solve the question, right, of national division, right? It just says, well, we can enact our national divisions in this way, it's important because it lowers the stakes a little bit, and it gives people some avenues to, sort of express themselves and have... recourse, right, so that they're not just being dictated to by just one authority. But I prefer a more dynamic model, right, where it is still possible to actually learn from one another, right? The point is not to settle on a system where we just have this kind of factioning, right, of views into these different jurisdictions. but rather that we are in the business of actually trying to learn from one another about what works. And we didn't really get to this, although it was kind of hinted at in the materials. But localism, right, if you think about mayors, I mean, mayors are probably some of the least partisan people you'll ever meet, because they actually have to solve real problems for real people. They don't have time, right, to spend on ideology or, you know, these kinds of things. So I imagine that, you know, this kind of, you know, I would love to go to the Conference of Mayors conference, right, to hear what they talk about, and, you know, where they find common ground in things that they're doing. And I just say that as a way of saying, yeah, I mean, structurally, you're right, but I hope it's in service of some more transcendent goal that can help unify the country.
As I would just add, I think mayors talk about potholes and sewage, and I think that's a good thing. Identifiable benefits delivered to identifiable individuals and imminent harms to identifiable individuals prevented. I don't think we're going to have a national divorce, and I don't think there's any cause to. I actually look at Americans as being far less divided than the popular press tends to describe us as. If we look at issue polling, admittedly a tricky business, we see a lot of issues, the toughest issues, there's not on all, but on many, Americans are clumped a bit toward the middle, sometimes a little bit more at one end or the other of the political spectrum. But we don't have any particular cause not to go forward as a nation. I believe that if the administrative state perhaps gets a little bit less bold in ways that trench on traditional state powers, and if the
we
U.S.
tried.
Supreme Court thinks, but as we see, we have a lot of momentum in that direction, and if the U.S. Supreme Court thinks a little bit more thoughtfully about how it's going to correct its own errors, right, stare decisis should not be some kind of national, right, they can certainly revisit things, whether they explicitly overrule or not, and in particular, if there's a bit more thought about considering the contours, limited contours of the of congressional powers, I actually think that things will calm down quite a bit, but we'll see.
I mean, can I just finish? It's a great way to end the conversation, because I think, first of all, the polarizations are probably a little overstated, but if you care about this, top down will always lead to more of it, and bottom up will always release it. So bottom up is always better off in this. And everything is not just red-blue. That's a very dangerous way to think, in my view. I mean, eminent domain's a great example of across the board, that norm has shifted. And as someone who grew up on the East Coast and has spent my adult life in the Midwest, let me just tell you, it ain't blue-red. It's coasts and money versus everyone else. And that actually explains our elections. And within a state like Ohio, we have very democratic cities. So we wouldn't even know how to do the divorce. It would be very complicated. This isn't Civil War stuff. How would you do it? The cities are a little more liberal. The suburbs are very ambiguous, and rural area more conservative. So I think it's a little more complicated than that. But I think just if you care about this as I do, bottom up is always your friend.
Okay, on that note, I think lunch is ready for everybody. So please join me in thanking our panelists.
Always.